This podcast is brought to you by Soapbox. Start your own podcast today at www.soapbox.host.
Welcome to Wednesday at 9 p.m., Season 3, Episode 3. Coming up on tonight's show, we find out the devil actually went down to Texas. Small town conspiracies, and why maybe you should rethink those goth girl fantasies. My name's Nick, and joining me as always are Aaron and Frank.
You hear that, Aaron?
Yeah, I hear that, Frank.
Me too. I'll take it to heart.
Very good. We'll do shout outs as usual. So I'll start. Shout out to my mom, who's excited that we started recording again. Frank?
Shout out to the Daisy in Cohoes, a little restaurant, bar and restaurant. After a month closure, they reopened and we went back and it was terrible. But we waited a few months, we went back today, and it's good again. So shout out to a local small business just trying to make it in these troubling times.
Fun fact, the Daisy is the precursor to the margarita.
Really?
Yes.
That makes a lot of sense. It's buy one, get one margs on Wednesdays. That's like their whole shtick.
Well, there you go.
Shout out to the Daisy, the precursor.
Which did you do, Frank? Did you buy one or did you get one?
I got one. They were not, the drinks were not very good.
Not like mine.
But shout out to them.
Yeah, just like they survived somehow. So that's good. They were going to shut down otherwise, but shout out to them and to Cameron, who was a big supporter of the show. I'll get him on one day again.
Aaron, anything from you?
All right. Well, shout out to Fallon as usual. And shout out to Troy from Nick.
Yes. You know,
longtime supporter. I believe he actually now officially created some artwork for the show.
Oh, he told you?
Yeah, he told me.
What did he tell you? Did he tell you though?
He told me which episode it was. So if you guys see a crudely drawn image, you can thank Troy for that.
Yeah. He emailed it into us, which you can too, at wednesday@9pm@gmail.com.
Excellent. I think that's all our housekeeping out of the way. Oh, David Hoy, shout out to you too, if you're still listening.
Of course.
Can you imagine we're just shouting him out and he hasn't listened since like episode 3 or something?
I mean, that probably did happen, but
yeah, for sure.
So guys, let me get all my stuff situated here. Tonight, we're going to talk about a story that I love. This is one of my favorite stories that I initially heard on Mysterious Universe. And it's not my all-time favorite, but it has quickly become a classic for me. And so tonight we will be going through parts of the book, The Devil's Best Trick by Randall Sullivan, which a link will be in the show notes. It's the premise of the book. He's kind of looking at like evil, like as a concept, the origins of evil. And that whole talk is kind of interlaced with this overarching story of a unsolved murder, more or less.
Wow. True crime
first,
episode. Like,
yeah. First true crime. So we won't get too much into all the like history and philosophical stuff he talks about. We're going to really focus on this mystery that happened in Texas. So, without further ado, we'll get into this whole, like, completely whole entire, like, chronology of this story, which at first for me, right? I don't normally do this kind of story, so I'm excited. So, Randall had a friend named Michelle, and she was in law enforcement to some capacity, and they were in a hotel together in New Orleans in June of 2013, and Michelle was there to like track down some like criminal. And while they were, you know, just chatting, Michelle had, you know, asserted to Randall that she believed in the power and presence of the supernatural, specifically evil. And she goes on to describe something she experienced when she was a teenager, starting in August of 1988 in a town called Lockhart, Texas. It's about 20 miles south of Austin. We'll put maps in the show notes. And at that time, she was, you know, classic tomboy, you know, wearing jeans, cutoffs, white t-shirt, Converse, always had her hair in a ponytail. So she was very much, she described it, young for her age. She was 17 at the time, but didn't, you know, act 17. She hung out with another group of teens, seven or eight of them, but they were all boys. So she's kind of putting that tomboy into aspect into perspective more. But one of the days in the summer, she was talking with her friend Eddie Reyna, and he lived in a big white house directly behind where her family lived. And she was called over by Eddie's mom to meet his cousin Mary. And this was about halfway through August of 1988. And she was told from Eddie's mom that Mary had been sent south from a town called Childress, which was in the northern part of West Texas, which is kind of that panhandle area, if you can imagine Texas in your mind. And there were some unspecified troubles that made her come down to Lockhart. And Eddie's mom thought, oh, well, you know, Michelle is the same age as Mary, so maybe she could show her around town, introduce her to people to try to make friends. And Mary goes on to describe meeting, or sorry, Michelle goes on to describe meeting Mary and saying that she didn't look like anyone she'd ever seen before. She was dressed all in black, her socks, her shoes, black hair, everything. But she had a very pale face, and she wasn't ugly, but she had freckles. She didn't wear any makeup. Michelle said she had nice skin, long eyelashes, but this sort of like blank expression. Michelle said she didn't really talk all that much, and she never smiled. And so Eddie's mom called Michelle over, a few days later after she was introduced to Mary to see how things were going. And Michelle said that they had barely talked, and she thought Mary was just kind of weird. Mrs. Reyna, she tried to, you know, keep telling her, come on, she just needs one friend. Just try. That's all she needs. And Michelle's like, okay, I'll try. And so one day, they, you know, Michelle and all of her friends are hanging out, and Mary's there, and Mary takes notice to this guy named Eric. And so Eric, it was just, you know, some guy in their friend group, and Mary started asking questions about him, and Michelle was just going like, oh, you know, he's Catholic, goes to church every Sunday, and she said Mary didn't like that at all. But, so to kind of go a little foreshadowing about where we might be going. Mary was like, well, he's still cute. So she essentially bought her way into this friend group. Michelle was not sure where she got the money, but she would invite them all out for pizza. They would, you know, go to play video games. And that was that. She was in the friend group. And around this time, Michelle also started to become intrigued by Mary. And to Michelle, it seemed that Mary was older, even though they were the same age, but she kind of made her feel embarrassed for being like a, like the tomboy and being kind of like, you know, a little girl. She didn't. So she kind of had this weird fascination with Mary, just about how she like carried herself. And so around Halloween that year of 1988, Mary had fully sort of entrenched herself into Mary's group, or into Michelle's group of friends. It's really tough that they both have an M name.
Yeah, you can't really like change either of them to like have a nickname.
No.
And even if you went with like Shelly or something, that's still, then you're with Mary Shelley.
Yeah, it's Frank. But anyway. No.
Yeah, I know.
So it's Halloween, and Mary's now in the group. They would gather at a field, tell scary stories, but Mary always had the scariest ones, and everyone always went home pretty frightened after she told her stories.
That's pretty cool.
And after that, though, Mary started to tell Michelle stuff about where she came from, and from Childress, and she asked Michelle once if she had ever done anything that she was like, was she felt really guilty about. And at the time she thought Michelle, or she thought Mary was going to say something to her, like she was going to confess, but the subject changed. And Mary described Childress as being this weird town with weird people in it. And just a few days later, Mary began talking about these strange dreams she was having.
Uh-oh.
Mary said that she had these dreams about a group called the Merchants of Death. And she said that they would meet at this place called the Haunted House in a town that was near Childress. And they would always put they would have a red light bulb on in the porch light when they were meeting, which was always the 24th of every month.
There was like a sign.
Yeah. Meeting here. Haunt Merchants of Death this way.
Just the red light.
Yep. Just a red light on the 24th of each month. And remember, this is a dream. And Mary said that they always performed some sort of sacrifice. Usually an animal, but she kind of alluded to that people were being sacrificed too. And she said to Michelle that the reason she left Childress was because two boys and two girls had already been killed there. And she was afraid she would be killed too. And so there was this weird, like, Michelle had a hard time telling what was real and what was a dream. And so Mary spoke of another dream that she had, like in one in particular, and again, dream, who knows? But the parents who owned this haunted house had run over a boy with their car because they were afraid he was going to rat them out to the police.
About what?
And we don't know. Michelle just would describe, or Michelle would say that Mary described it so vividly. And it felt like she was actually just like seeing a scary movie play out. Michelle never told her parents anything that Mary was saying. And Michelle remembered saying to Mary, like, why don't you ask for God's help? And Mary said, I don't believe in God. I believe in the devil.
Oh.
Right. And that was a quote. I don't believe that. just need to put that out there. And Michelle's just shocked. And she's like, why? And Mary says, because the devil makes things happen. That puts into perspective the kind of person Mary is.
What kind of reason would that even be if that was true?
Well, we'll get into some more things right now. So, sometime later, I don't know the exact date, but Mary and Michelle had gone to Eddie's, or they were at Eddie's house, and Mary convinced everyone to do a Ouija board session in the attic. And Mary had talked before about someone called the Thane, who was the leader of this group back in Childress. And when they were all together, she said that the Thane and the devil spoke to her through the Ouija board. And at one point, Michelle, she said, "I swear, Randall, Mary took her hands off the planchette and it kept moving on its own."
Oh, no.
Everyone was freaked out. They all ran out of the room. Everyone was yelling. There were these two black teenagers in the group, Mac and Ernie. They said they were never going to go near Mary again. They never did. They don't get mentioned. They're just out of there.
Yeah, they're smart.
I know. So that brings us to the winter, right as we roll into 1989. And Michelle invited Mary over for a sleepover. And Michelle's mom told her that Mary couldn't come over unless she changed her clothes. Like, she couldn't wear all black. And Mary said she didn't have anything else. So Mary had to get clothes lended to her from Michelle. And so they get ready for bed. Mary gets laid down on the floor with like pillows and quilts and stuff like that. And she starts complaining about this Virgin of Guadalupe nightlight that Michelle's mom has in the house. And Michelle says like her mom had it to, you know, ward off evil spirits and things like that. And wouldn't you know it, Mary didn't like the nightlight.
Does it say if she could, like, did she see it or did she like sense there was?
No. Yeah. So Mary said that Mary demanded that Michelle turn it off. And they actually had a really big fight about it. And Michelle told her to go home.
Wow.
But Mary didn't end up leaving. And Mary had then started talking about another dream that she had talked about before. It's where Mary described this group of people, again, who met at the haunted house, these merchants of death. They were gathered around a fire in some pasture with trees, and she could see the, Mary said she could see the faces of the people, and she knew who they were, but she couldn't remember the names.
Weren't masked or anything?
No. And then she transitioned from that to a story that she was supposed to join that group. She was supposed to be there. And someone was supposed to pick her up at a restaurant at midnight and drive her there. But no one ever showed up. Eventually, another person from this group picked her up and told her, "Tate's dead." Mary knew a Tate. He was this really cute guy who lived in Childress. And the person who picked her up said that Tate had been talking about committing suicide. And so, quote, "we helped him to do it."
Whoa, this is still in the dream?
Well, so, and that's what Michelle asked. Michelle's just like, "this is still your dream." Yeah. Like, Mary didn't answer that question. A few nights later, Mary came back talking about that same dream, only she described seeing Tate hanging from a rope and watching as the rope broke. They got a stronger rope and hung him again. And Mary kind of candidly said, "we sacrificed him."
Wait, well.
So,
we or they?
All in her. We.
Oh.
So she, again, this is all in the dream. And so the last time that Michelle and Mary were alone, they were at Michelle's house. Yeah. And all of Michelle's family was out and they were in the kitchen, and Michelle went to go grab a soda from the fridge, and she turned and she hears Mary saying, "I've told you so much, too much, but you're too stupid to figure out what I'm telling you. Maybe I should just kill you before you put it all together." And as Michelle turns around, Mary is holding a kitchen knife raised above her shoulder, like she's going to stab her. And Michelle, quick thinking, grabbed the lid of the trash can and kind of, she had it like a shield out.
Damn.
And she swung it at her and they danced around this weird, like, give and take sort of. And she really thought that Mary was going to stab her. And then all of a sudden, Mary just starts laughing and drops the knife. And Michelle just tells her to leave.
Just a prank.
Yeah, just a prank, guys. And Michelle saw Mary only one time after that. It was on the street in March of 1989.
Michelle says
a couple months.
Couple months. So she got introduced to Mary in the summer of 1988.
Okay.
And Mary said to Michelle that the Thane and the devil spoke to her through the Ouija board and commanded her to go back to Childress. So Mary leaves, and Michelle, who's, you know, at the time she thought she was a, you know, pretty good artist, she made these drawings of the scenes that Mary had described when she was talking about her dreams. The house with the red porch light, the boy being run over, the other boy hanging from the tree in a windbreak planted along the border of two cotton farms. She took all these drawings she made and brought them to the Lockhart Police Department. And, you know, she told the investigator there the story of how she was associated with Mary, start to finish, and handed him the drawings. He must have been impressed enough at the time and sent them to the police up in Childress. And apparently they were startlingly closely matched to locations and events that did actually take place in and around Childress. There was an abandoned home in a nearby town called Kirkland that had a red porch light and it was called the Haunted House. And it had burned to the ground only recently, under mysterious circumstances that may or may not have involved arson. And there was a 15-year-old boy who had been killed in a hit and run while walking home from work. He was a dishwasher at a local restaurant. And that was only a couple blocks from the haunted house. No one was arrested. But the kind of real kicker here was the eeriness of Michelle's drawings of a scene north of town at a place called Boxer's Corner, where the corpse of 17-year-old Tate Rowland had been found hanging from the branch of a horse apple tree in July of 1988, only a couple weeks before Mary showed up in Lockhart, Texas.
Oh my God.
So that is the setup for where we're going.
That's the
setup.
Jeez.
That's the setup. That's in chapter two. We got like six more chapters.
Oh my God. So first thing I want to say is, after the Ouija board nonsense, that's a huge red flag. I'm done with that person. If they're just like, yeah, I'm going to start like cackling and we're going to like, you know, summon this person, and they just start talking about these dreams in vivid detail, I think I'm done. I wouldn't keep inviting you back to my house.
I'd have to agree.
Like, I don't know if she felt bad that she didn't have any friend. Like, she being Michelle didn't. Michelle felt bad that Mary didn't have any friends. It is really tough to do the two names.
Yeah, Mary is the person with the crazy dreams that tried to kill Michelle with a knife.
But I feel like Michelle felt bad for Mary, and that's why she kept inviting her back. But if it were me, I'm sorry, you get one time of feeling bad, and then you start talking or doing some evil, dark stuff, and you're done.
Yeah, I mean, totally.
So my reading of this, the subtext here, not too sub, I guess, is that these weren't dreams.
Yeah, that's the gist.
So is it alluded to that she is part of this group, or just that? Because I know she said we at some points. But
yeah, so that, to my understanding, that is what is alluded, but that's, we don't hear about Mary anymore. We're going to be solely focusing on Tate Roland and what happened and what transpired in Childress, Texas in 1988.
Just curious.
Years after.
Did it mention anything about Mary's family?
No. Nope. It's just that she was Eddie's cousin.
Mm-hmm.
And that she had to come down from Childress to Lockhart because of some unspecified troubles with the family. It doesn't say anything about Mary's parents.
So I'm starting to imagine like the scene here in Childress, Texas. I'm guessing it's like a really small town, right? Kind of middle of nowhere. Yeah,
and I think, because there's a lot to get through, so that kind of segues nicely into the beginning here of chapter 3. So Childress was, you know, big railroad industry.
Mm.
And then that's what, you know, a lot of employment was. And then classic, the interstate happened and a lot of the commerce that Childress once thrived on was gone.
Just like the movie Cars.
Yeah, exactly.
It's also,
they did. Ahead. Yep. I was going to say, they did get a highway that went through it that got you up to Oklahoma. So it was kind of this touristy thing that it was the gateway to the panhandle of Texas. But still, it was a pretty poor town after the interstate got built in the mid 1950s. There was a prison that eventually got built in the 90s, early 90s, but until then it was like cotton farming was the main sort of economic driver in the town. Most people struggled to pay a mortgage, even though the houses on average only cost $30,000, less than $30,000. And the population at the time was about 5,800 people. Wow. And that brings us to Tate Roland, who was actually one of the more privileged kids in town. His dad, Jimmy, worked for the Burlington Northern Railroad. So he operated heavy equipment. So he made a bit more money, and he provided for his family and especially for Tate. His stepmother, Brenda, described him spoiled rotten, but not in like the bad way, more in the sort of loving way. Like Jimmy, his father, just loved him so much. He wanted him to have the world. And I say stepmother, Jimmy had won custody of Tate after he and his second wife divorced, and that was when Tate was 12. So when his dad was gone working, so he had to be gone for some days at a time, and he would, you know, travel a lot. So when he wasn't home, his aunt and older sister, along with Brenda, would watch over Tate while his dad was gone. He supported Tate's career as a motorcycle racer. He did, like, I'm assuming it's sort of this like dirt biking. And apparently he was really good at it. He won championships in his division in Texas, and over, he was just a really popular kid. People had a lot of good things to say about him, but, you know, typical high school kid in the 80s, you know, you think you're invincible. He had the sandy hair, girls really liked him, compact blue eyes, and he'd fight anyone who challenged him. He'd lose almost every time, but he'd still do it just because he had this like gusto about him. And he even, on a dare, jumped his motorcycle over a pickup truck front to back with a bunch of girls standing in the bed of the truck.
So
he's this like small town.
Sure.
Like celebrity guy that just people know him. And if he wasn't, you know, doing all of that, he was driving his souped up 1980 Ford pickup that his dad bought him for his 16th birthday. And he would, you know, they would do drag races, all that stuff. And he did eventually wreck his truck. And he one of his friends is quoted saying, it was like he lost a part of himself. I don't think that has any deeper meaning, but just he really loved that truck. And he always seemed to be after this girl named Karen Hackler, who was this daughter of a pretty well-to-do cotton farmer. And she was, you know, a cute young woman. And they had become this, you know, item when he was a sophomore in high school. But it had been pretty rocky right from the get-go. The families agreed that, you know, the relationship itself didn't really have a future. Tate, again, like I said, was just in his sophomore year, so he was going to be 16 that year, or, you know, shortly. Karen was almost 21.
Whoa, whoa, whoa.
So
were they in
pretty big age gap?
Were they in the
gap.
Same school, or they met outside of school?
I think they must have met outside of school.
Okay. Just because I don't judge. I didn't know if she, like, I held back a few times.
No, I mean, I don't know. But yeah, so pretty big age gap. So they think, you know, both families were like, this isn't even going to work out. And according to Karen's family, after like a year or so, she tried to break up with Tate multiple times, but he wouldn't let it go. He committed like these little petty crimes. He stole her pocketbook or some jewelry. Man. He'd like drive up and spray gravel against her family's front door. And
that'll show finally, him.
And then in January of 1988, Karen had Tate charged with assault because he was choking her in a parking lot on the main drag.
Oh my town. God.
And Jimmy and the rest of it and his aunt, like the Roland family, was like, okay, you know what, Tate? This is, he didn't get like indicted. There was a no bill. So he didn't go to prison or anything, but his family was like, Tate, you need to figure yourself out. So he had to move to Louisiana to live with his older sister and complete his junior year of high school there. And he finished with decent grades, 4 A's, 3 B's, 2 C's and a D.
So your average student.
The D was in health class because he never went to health class. So Tate then comes back to Childress in June of 1988. And he was confronted by two pretty big changes. One, unsurprisingly, Jimmy Roland, his father, ended up marrying Brenda. They were just dating at the time, but now they had officially married, and she was his stepmom now. The other one was that, oh, sorry, I should also mention that Brenda had 2 children from her first marriage. So now he has like step siblings as well. But the other change was that Karen Hackler had married a man named Philip Clapper or Clapper. And Philip was 2 years older than Karen. He wanted to be a farmer. So that much more realistic relationship. And everyone agreed that Tate, at first, he was like beside himself, crestfallen, and he didn't want to believe that Karen had actually married someone. And he tried to convince her that it was a mistake. Let's go on a date. Come on. But nothing came of it. And according to most of his friends, his stepmom and his dad, after a week or two, he was back to normal. That same mischievous smile, chasing after girls, drinking beer every night. But everyone did that back then. So it wasn't like, you know, he was this depressed alcoholic.
Everyone was depressed alcoholic back then.
Of course. There was one friend, Clifton Hodges, that later would say Tate had, quote, showed some depression over Karen when he would have a beer or two. And that he had once remarked he wanted to have the George Jones song, "He Stopped Loving Her Today," played at his funeral. So one person saying that maybe it was worse, but everyone else seemed or said he was fine. And, you know, he was looking forward to finishing high school. He was going to join the Air Force. And he seemed more upset about having to drive Brenda's old Thunderbird, her Ford Thunderbird, instead of his nice souped up truck that he lost. So there was one thing that was weird, though, when he came back. That a lot of his friends were like, that doesn't seem right. He was spending a lot of time with this kid named Chad Johnston. Chad, who wasn't even 15 yet. So he was, you know, pretty young, either going into his freshman or sophomore year of high school. He was new to Childress. His family had just moved into town a year earlier, and they opened a donut shop. And he was described as a quiet, unpopular kid. So you could see why Chad would want to hang out with Tate, because everyone liked him. But it wasn't really clear why Tate would want to hang out with Chad. One of my favorite quotes in this is from one of Tate's friends. "Tate had girls chasing him and guys wanting to party with him. I don't think anybody was wanting to party with Chad."
Aw, poor Chad.
So, well, maybe not so much. So it's July 26, 1988. Tate is hanging out mostly with Chad. They're hanging around the Roland house. This is according to Brenda, because she was out in and out of the house all day. And it was weird that Tate had kind of been inside most of the day, because he also liked to be out doing something, you know, chasing after girls, riding his dirt bike, all that kind of stuff. But according to her, he didn't seem unhappy or depressed by any means. He came into the backyard where Brenda and his sister, Terry, were sorting items for this garage sale. He promised to help them move some stuff. And he was also coaching this woman's softball team that Brenda was playing on in the summer. And he assured her that there would be a 7:30 practice that evening. Brenda didn't see Chad during this. He just sort of stayed inside, but she saw the two of them leaving the house around 4 o'clock. And like I said, Tate seemed fine. Several of Tate's friends recalled seeing him driving around or at the drag, again, this kind of like main street, around 5. And one of his closest friends, Bobby Reynolds, said they met in the parking lot and they had made plans to have some beer after Tate got done helping with the softball practice. Tate then got into the driver's seat of the Thunderbird with Chad sitting next to him. and they just drove off. And then an hour later, so it's about 6 o'clock, Brenda's just cooking dinner. Jimmy had made a surprise visit home. He doesn't normally, I think it was like a, yeah, it was a Tuesday. He doesn't normally come home on Tuesdays. But she's, you know, frying up some chicken for him. And the front door bursts open and Chad comes sprinting in saying, Jim Earl, Tate's dead. And Brenda turns around. It's like, don't kid about that. And Chad's like, no, he's dead. And then they're all in a panic, like, where, what's going on? The three of them get into Jimmy's truck and drive to the northern edge of town to Boxer's Corner. And it got that name because, like, high school boys, you know, I'll meet you at 3 o'clock. That's where they would go fight. And before they were even close enough to park the car, Brenda saw Tate hanging by a rope from the thickest branch of that horse apple tree.
Oh my God. Imagine.
With his toes just inches from the ground. And Jimmy cut his own son down and he was trying CPR, but obviously nothing was working. So Tate was sadly gone. And at this point, the only people who really believed that Tate had committed suicide were the people in position to make that assertion. And what's going to happen is you're going to see some terrible, terrible police work that muddies this whole thing and just makes it more complicated than it needed to be. So the sheriff's deputy, David Morris, was called to the scene and he was new to the position, appointed by Sheriff Claude Lane, who had been elected with no law enforcement background.
Oh, boy.
Yeah. Reese Bowen, who was the junior deputy, but much older than David Morris, the senior deputy, said that Claude Lane was literally a farmer who ran for sheriff and won. He described him as being right off the tractor. No training, no academies, nothing. And so Sheriff Lane made it clear that Tate Roland's death was a suicide. And that was all that it was. And Deputy Morris, we don't really know what he thought, but he owed his job to Sheriff Lane, and so he was going to do what the sheriff told him to do. And Tate's suicide came odd, right? Because there was this eyewitness, Chad Johnston, and he told an almost plausible story. So Deputy Morris might have actually believed Chad's story. So how it goes is Chad said he went over to Tate's house that day right around noon and they watched a movie on the VCR. He made a phone call to Karen that lasted about 30 minutes and he called her back soon after for another 15 minutes. It was about 3 o'clock and Tate began to sharpen a knife and this is a quote from Chad. Was talking about life not being worth living. He was telling me not to get involved with a girl because they do you wrong.
Mm.
And Chad said then he took the knife away from Tate. And then Tate then suggested, let's go find someone to get some beer so Tate could get drunk for the last time, is what Chad is quoted as saying. They left the house in Tate's Thunderbird. And they got a young woman named Lisa to buy them a 12-pack of Coors Light. And then they drove out to Boxer's Corner. They had been drinking for about 45 minutes. And Tate said he wanted to go back to the house. And Chad is saying that was when Tate must have gotten the rope and put it in the trunk of his car. But he said he didn't see that because I had went inside the house. They drove back to Boxer's Corner, and he said Tate started talking about his funeral, who he wanted to be there. Chad said he asked if he wanted Karen there, and Tate said, if she wanted to. And then at some point in all this, Chad walks around the corner, throws the beer bottle away, goes to the bathroom. He said it took him about 3 minutes, and when he came back, Tate was hanging from the tree. He went to go look at him. He was dead. So he got into Tate's Thunderbird and drove to Jimmy and Brenda to tell them what happened. He said Jimmy cut Tate down, took the rope off his neck, and they got, you know, paramedics, and the rest is where we kind of ended there. So Reese Bowen, again, this junior deputy, but who actually kind of knows what's going on, never believed it was a suicide. He thinks Deputy Morris knew too, but again, he was never going to admit it because he wanted to keep his job. And Bowen cites three reasons why it likely wasn't a suicide. One, as I've kind of been explaining, Tate didn't seem like the type of guy to kill himself. He was outgoing, popular, you know, raised hell and chased after girls. You know, he had some issues, but nothing that would describe that he was suicidal. The other thing that Reese or Deputy Bowen was bothered by was, quote, the cold personality of the kid who was with him, Chad. He said that he was so matter of fact when he described how he saw Tate hanging. No feeling, no expression. He said, most people would show you more emotion if they told you it was raining outside.
Wow.
So it was this cold delivery that didn't feel right. And we could argue for however long about, well, those are subjective, right? That's just how you're interpreting this. But there was one forensic reason not to believe this was a suicide. One thing Deputy Morris did do correctly was photograph Tate's body. And after the photos were developed, there were two distinct sets of rope marks on Tate's throat. One above the Adam's apple and one below. And so in law enforcement, it's well known that if someone hangs themselves or is hung, the rope slides up above the Adam's apple and leaves only one mark. The separate marks were not mentioned in the inquest that was held the following morning at the courthouse. The omissions in Chad's statement also were odd. He failed to say anything about how the rope got slung over the branch, when and where the knots were tied, or how it actually got placed around Tate's neck. And Brenda remembered that the rope itself wasn't even tied in a noose. It was just tied in like about a dozen knots. I mean, I'm no rope expert, but it doesn't seem the way that you would do that.
And done in like 3 minutes?
And done in 3 minutes,
yeah. I have a different issue with the 3 minutes. So,
well, okay. let me get through this. So, based entirely on Chad's interview, a county judge and a justice of the peace signed off and ruled Tate's death a suicide. No one believed it, like I've said, and everyone was incredibly suspicious of Chad, but aggressively, it got really bad. Word spread that Chad. Oh, sorry. It got bad for Chad because he then went to the Roland home 2 days after Tate died and said Tate wants this color of coffin. He wants this song played at his funeral. And oh, by the way, he wants me to have his car and all the money is in his bank account.
What? And this kid is what, 13, 14?
Yeah, 14 or 15.
Okay.
Jimmy screams at him, telling him to get out of the house. And now Chad and his family are, no one wants anything to do with them. It was also weird. Brenda recalls that Chad's mother had signed the guest book as Chad's mother in at Tate's funeral. Not even her first name, just Chad's mother. And rumors spread about Chad, his mom, his stepfather, and it just got so bad that less than a month after Tate died, Chad and his family closed its donut shop and moved. They left Childress. They were there. Perhaps. And a lot of weird stuff happened at the funeral itself. There was a man rocking in the front row, repeating the word suicide over and over again. And a few days after the funeral, the Childress Police Department got a tip from a high school student, and they sent out a car to Boxer's Corner. And just a couple hundred yards from what was now deemed the hanging tree, there was a cow skull lodged in the branches of a smaller tree and a stack of logs surrounding a pile of rocks. And the officer described that as an altar in his report.
Yuri. And
it spread like wildfire that Tate had been the sacrificial victim of a satanic cult that was active in and around Childress. And depending on who you talk to, that it just spread and spread for, it took maybe days, weeks, months, if you really weren't paying attention, but it was chaos in terms of the rumors. There was another Childress police officer who said one night in August while he was on patrol, saw a figures in quotes, by the way, standing by Tate Roland's grave. And when he returned, there was like spit all over the gravestone.
Oh my God.
The Childress Police Department during the final weeks of the summer also had reports that a cross had been seen burning over Tate's grave, and apparently a school teacher's dog had been stolen and ritually sacrificed. So every high school student now heard that, or the rumor was, Tate himself was a member of a cult and had been killed by his fellow cult members because he wouldn't bring them a blonde-haired, blue-eyed child to be sacrificed. And it's odd because Brenda's two daughters are blondes, and Tate's older sister, Terry, had four blonde daughters. And this kind of got a little more believable because Terry had told her family that Tate had warned her to keep her daughters indoors. And to make it even more like things happening everywhere, the DA, David McCoy, said that about the same time when this was happening, these rumors, there were reports of strangers in cars showing up at like the elementary school parking lot, grade school for Frank, trying to pick up small children. And so the high school in Childress was just swarming with rumors. There were even rumors that their fellow classmates were members of the satanic cult that had sort of permeated and infected the town, and who is rumored to be responsible for Tate's death. And most people talked about like the football team. It, you know, Texas football is a big thing in this football team in this year was exceptional. But most people were talking about what happened with Tate and the rumors of a satanic cult. One lineman on the football team actually organized an investigation into figuring out more about the cult. There was a rumor that they were going, the cult was going to dig up Tate's body on Halloween night because they needed a pinky bone. So he, this lineman, 240 pounder in high school. He's a big, big boy. He and 15 kids, they assemble at the cemetery on Halloween, park their cars by the storage shed. And then they all climbed into the bed of his truck and drove slowly towards where Tate's grave was. And as they get there, they hear sounds like it's almost like chanting. And someone's like, "Do you hear that? Like, is that music playing?" And so the football player stopped his truck so everyone could listen. And then almost immediately, some headlights turned on where Tate's grave was. And everyone was freaking out. He whips the car around and is booking it away from there. He goes back through the gates of the cemetery. And as they're driving, someone notices pentagrams had been drawn on the cemetery shed. And it's just adding to the chaos. The headlights keep following them. Several kids jumped out of the back of the truck while it was still going and ran to their cars to speed off in different directions. Eventually, they get to the Childress County Courthouse, and the vehicle that was following them finally turns away and turns back around. They sat there for a bit and eventually did head back so people could get their cars. And when they got back at the shed, there was a large pentagram painted on the door and dozens of candles were burning all around their cars. He and a few other students returned to the cemetery the next day. And they walked together to where Tate was buried, and there were beer cans scattered all around the perimeter, and someone had overturned his headstone. So I'll stop there for a second.
Oh, man, that's a lot to take in.
Yeah.
Yeah, did you take notes? So,
no, but my noggin will hopefully serve me well. So one thing I wanted to mention is another reason that the police should have automatically assumed that Chad did something is in the time it takes for you to go to the bathroom, even if the person had the noose ready and hung himself instantly, they would not have died in that amount of time. I do not believe.
I don't know much about the mechanics of hanging, but I know that it probably didn't. You'll see also why Chad's story doesn't really add up, but it doesn't make sense for someone to tie a rope that's not a noose, put it around their necks by themselves, and then hang themselves all in the span of 3 minutes.
Yeah, so it could take up to like several minutes more than however long. So I don't know. And you wouldn't even try to cut him down at that point. Like,
right. So he drove back to the Roland house to get Brenda and Jimmy. Yeah. And Jimmy then cut him down after they got there.
So that part should have tipped him off. Another thing that I wanted to theorize as to what's going on here, because obviously there's a lot of rumors, so I'm going to add one more.
Oh, God.
So based on your story with Mary and Michelle, I'm wondering if Chad almost, like, I don't know how they became friends to begin with, but I'm wondering if Chad was kind of like exploiting his sadness to the point where he's like, "Hey, man, you know, we can help you. We, you know, I got a group of people that can help you," or whatever. And I'm almost wondering,
right, and that
if he was going to do, like, or he did what Mary was trying to do with Michelle. And like, because she asked the question of, have you ever done anything that you regret?
Or feel really guilty about?
Yeah. So I'm wondering if it wasn't the same tactic that Mary was trying to employ.
Maybe. I mean, the rumors are that Tate himself was in this cult and he was punished.
I don't know.
And but also remember, Mary said that Tate was talking about committing suicide and we helped him to do it. That's what Mary said to Michelle.
I could believe that because I you don't just uproot your life for a year, find out things are drastically different, and be okay in a couple weeks, in my opinion.
Well, by drastically different, it's just this girl that he liked married someone. Other than that, he still had all his friends. Everything was okay at home.
Yeah, I mean.
And he was back to himself. The only difference was Chad. They were hanging out.
Yeah, I don't know. It's still a big adjustment, in my opinion, to just come back to that and be like, yep, that's totally good. Especially if he was
Well, I respect your theory. It will be increasingly clear that I think you'll be convinced otherwise. Okay. Frank, do you have anything before we continue?
Yeah, it smells very fishy. And when you hear stories of botched investigations and police work, it obviously begs the question of how much of it is ignorance or, you know, lack of skill versus more malicious, intentional.
And we'll get into something like that. So I think all good ideas, definitely odd.
For sure. Sad too. Definitely very odd. Sad.
And everything that happened after what I just told about the high school students going to the cemetery on Halloween.
Oh yeah. On that last thing.
Oh yeah. If you want to,
that's not probably the right thing here, but separate from how tragic the actual death is, it's very interesting to hear how rumor flies, right? And already a suspicious thing turns into crazier and crazier and crazier rumors. Like,
they're going to dig him up and take his pinky bone
on Halloween night, right? Like very goofy rumors. It's like that also makes the water murkier in terms of figuring out what of this is true, right? Whether this is false. And this sounds like it was in that satanic panic time period too.
Yes, it was.
So like
kind of right near the tail end of it.
We weren't alive there. And whenever I hear about the satanic panic, half of me goes, oh yeah, those stupid people back then, they all scared themselves over nothing. And the other half of me goes, well, we weren't alive back then. We don't know what was going on or how it actually felt. So I find that period very interesting because we don't know if how it's reported today is accurate to what happened back then. And we don't know. Yeah. Cause people now,
and it's classic small town Americana.
Exactly.
Too.
Right. So it's entirely
no internet.
Yeah. No, very secluded. You can get away with crazy stuff, right? Like hit and runs. I mean, it's hard and hard to get away with even just that. So
is that a complaint, Frank?
No comment.
Is this a confession? Do you ever feel guilty about something?
I'm gonna start wearing all black next episode. No.
Perfect.
Yeah, it just makes me wonder, like, how much does the satanic panic ideas play into this, into the rumors?
And I mean, the pentagram, the candles.
Yeah.
There's no reason to believe those kids were all lying.
Yeah, that's the crazy part, right? But you hear that all that stuff was made up. There was no serious cult stuff. That people will say that never happened at all. It was completely dumb, you know, country people,
mass hysteria,
or conservative people freaking out about, you know, non-Christian stuff. So it's very interesting. It's like, is there an ounce of truth to this? It's sounding like maybe.
Well, we'll do a bit more. Okay, so like I said, a lot of good theory from all you guys, and we'll dig a bit deeper here. As I had stated before, Tate had no problems at home that were reported. He didn't have to worry about Frank is putting up his skull right now on camera, yeah, just so you know. Head. Our
probably
our skeleton
from Walmart, taste, not an actual human skull, people. Frank is not in correct. A cult.
Yeah, from Walmart. Yeah.
Target, wherever.
Yep. But no, anyway.
Yeah, it was.
There were no problems at home. Tate didn't have to worry about money. As I've said, his dad bought him a lot of great things. He bought him a new motorbike and, you know, spoiled him. He had the same friends for years. Girls were chasing him, and he was in love with Karen, but he never seemed distraught, according to Brenda. And he was moving on to her from her perspective. And so everyone in town at this point had heard that a satanic cult was involved in Tate's death. And Brenda would try to go to the sheriff's office asking, like, hey, what are we going to do? What's going on? And he always just kind of brushed her under the door or not under the door, under the carpet and like just kind of ignored her and didn't really pursue anything. So even though Sheriff Lane did not want to reopen Tate Rowland's case, the Childress Police Department continued to collect evidence that put some credence to this satanic cult rumor. So one of these came out from Cottle County Jail in a town called Paducah, which is about 30 miles south of Childress. And apparently Tate and some of his friends from the Panhandle area would drive down there to drink beer and flirt with some of the girls who have oil money.
Oh, nice.
And Tate had apparently been arrested on a drunken disorderly charge at a dance in Paducah on July 9th, 1988. So that's about just over 2 weeks before he died. And Trooper Carl Holloway answered a call from the dance that a young man was causing problems. Trooper Holloway shows up. There's a wobbly-legged, intoxicated, and belligerent Tate on the edge of the dance floor. Trooper Holloway drops him off at the county jail. And Beatrice Perkins, who was the deputy that booked him into lockup, said, "I remember he kind of acted weird, hypertensive, excited." And she's quoted as saying, "I remember he said he was with the devil. He was talking about this bunch of Satanists he was with. The reason it stuck in my mind is that we never had anyone talk about that before. I remember that word, Satanists, standing out." And so the Cottle County Sheriff, Frank Taylor, said that he heard that basically the same story from other deputies who were working the night shift at the jail. And it was just, there was a bunch of talk from this young guy in lockup about the devil and Satanists he was involved with. He eventually just had to pay a fine. He seemed, you know, nice on the phone with the Justice of the Peace. He was well-mannered, so he just had to pay some fines and he was on his way. Another incident that, again, is giving credence to this whole Satanist thing. During the early morning hours of November 6th, 1988, exactly 1 week after the incident at the cemetery on Halloween night, A man phoned the Childress Police Department to say that someone was in the process of stealing his 1977 Chevy from outside of his home. Patrol cars were dispatched, and they spotted a car matching that description speeding east on Avenue A, and it slid off the road and crashed into a utility pole. When they arrived, they found Ray Wilkes, who was just about to turn 16, alone in the front seat. The Wilkes family was very well known to law enforcement in bad ways.
Oh.
His dad, Frank Wilkes, and his two youngest sons had four felonies combined. And it was regularly, or the police department regularly had calls to the Wilkes home. But there, Ray Wilkes was laying face down on the seat, and he placed his hands under his torso, informing the two officers he intended to kill them both.
Oh.
But they managed to get Ray out of the vehicle and into handcuffs. The police noted the heavy metal and swastika tattoos that were on his forearms. And the suspect is quoted, or it's quoted, the suspect became violent acting and he attempted physical attack upon officers. He got sent to the Childress County Hospital for medical evaluation before any of this was going on, or before like any further action was taken. And he made terroristic threats to kill his father and mother if released to their custody. And he further stated that he was a member of a cult that was like a local cult. And he made the statement that he and several other persons locally had been involved in a cult sacrifice of an individual in Childress County in July of 1988, who was identified as Tate Rowland.
Oh.
So clearly there was something is happening here.
Unless he's lying. Making it up.
Now we're going to roll into 1989 in Childress. We've already been 1989 in Lockhart with everything going on with Mary and Michelle. This is in Childress. Karen Hackler was under a lot of suspicion as well, much like Chad and his family. Apparently, Karen kept witchcraft books in a Ouija board in her bedroom. And rumors spread that she was the queen bee of the cult. And many people reported hearing that she seduced Tate into the cult. So not the rumor. The rumor is now that Karen's a part of the cult and seduced Tate into joining.
What?
Not Chad playing up on the sadness that Tate may have been feeling and saying, hey, we can help you. So I don't know. Again, I don't know where these rumors came from, but that's the rumor. And when the high school kids would see Karen on the drag, they would do this to them.
Oh my and God.
Right now I'm putting my two index fingers together like a cross as if I'm warding off something evil.
Nice.
So Karen's now getting a lot of ridicule and derisiveness as well. But as I mentioned him, Chad is still the subject of a lot of rumors. And there were rumors that Chad's family were central members of the cult, and Chad was just raised by devil worshippers. And as the weeks went on, many other names were added to this list of those believed to be involved with this cult. It seemed, according to Brenda, that it felt like almost everyone was a member of the cult. There were so many rumors. So many sure. people in town were supposedly involved. Maybe not everyone, but just, you know, a lot of people were rumored. And do you want to know the weird
Tate's
thing about
dad
it?
Is in the cult.
Oh, no, no.
The two the little people, girls are. Oh.
All the people that were rumored to be in the cult moved out of town. Again, could be coincidental. Like, imagine you're in this town and people are saying that you're in this satanic cult. You might want to leave too.
What I want to know is, do they move to the same place?
Oh, that's a good question.
They all moved next door to the other town.
Well, Brenda said the ones whose names were brought up as being members of this cult, within a short period of time, anywhere from 2 weeks to less than a year after Tate died, all of them were no longer living in Childress. So anyone who was rumored to be involved in under a year, all of them had moved out of town. Again, could be a coincidence, but that's pretty odd.
I mean,
Karen, namely, did not move out of town, I should mention.
Well, I don't think she was in it personally, because it just doesn't line up. Like, she all but pretty much had a restraining order against Tate. And
well, yeah,
it's part of the plan.
What? Okay.
All I'm trying to say is she was rumored to be in it and actually seduced Tate into it. And people would, you know, do the whole cross thing. But she didn't even leave town. So these other people that were rumored to be a part of it, Karen was getting just as much heat and talk behind her back as they were, if not worse.
Maybe the
why did they leave and she didn't?
That she was going to be the quote unquote sacrifice and be the one that takes the fall for all of it. And they'll continue to spread their mission or some ungodliness.
This all makes it sound. This makes it sound like mass hysteria, though. Like, I heard my neighbor is in the cult. Oh, I heard my neighbor's in the cult. That
sounds
dog
like
is in the
a
cult.
Witch hunt.
You know?
Right. But it's not everyone in the town. I misspoke earlier. It's just the people who were rumored to be in the cult, all of them left.
It is weird. I would love to know if they all, or if a lot of them went to similar places. Or like, you know, did
now
they...
Maybe one of these days I'll look for like deed records in Childress, Texas in the 80s and try to follow, like, see, oh my God, they all moved to the Bronx.
Checks out. Because
there's already enough stuff happening.
There was a bunch of arson in the 80s in the Bronx, just like the haunted house here.
There you go.
Oh my God. Actually, I did live next to Palm Bay Park, where there were in fact rumors of altars and sacrifices.
Yep.
Frank, where were your
like 5 minutes from me
in the 80s?
Were your parents in Texas in 1988?
Well, you say it. When I was born, my parents just were all black. I'm gonna have to come back for another episode on this.
Excellent. So the local law enforcement still continued to collect evidence of some sort of satanic activity in the Childress area. They didn't really talk about what Michelle had provided in everything related to Mary, you know, which again happened in Lockhart, which is like 400 miles south. It's pretty far away. But word somehow got out what the sheriff's deputies found, and when they ran a search warrant on the old house on the south side of town, apparently the owner had a contract with the government to house disabled people, like mentally disabled. I won't use the word that Deputy Bowen used, but you could imagine what he called them.
I see.
Different time. But Deputy Bowen said they had received reports that he was sexually abusing them.
Oh.
And abusing them in other ways too. And when they went in with the search warrant, they found evidence of the occult in the owner's bedroom. There was a cache of art, which was this disgusting mix of like satanic stuff and pornography. I have it highlighted. I don't think we'll get into what some of those images are.
Oh, you have a list.
Well, yeah.
Are the images going to be in the show notes?
Yeah. No.
The thumbnail?
Look in the, you know, go to the police report from 1988. Probably public record.
I wonder, is it digitized, you know?
I don't know. But so just, you know, odd drawings. Another drawing, which is maybe a bit more tame, was that the state of Texas with a pentagram drawn inside of it.
Oh.
And there was also a black cloak and a pointed hat with and a wand with a goat head on it. So imagine in Harry Potter, you know, Lucius has his wand with a snake head at the end.
Like an actual size goat head? Okay.
No. Probably okay. Just like a carving of a goat head. And so right around this same time, June 1989, so it's almost 1 year since Tate died, Dallas's D magazine published an article about reports of crimes committed by, quote, avowed satanic worshipers all across northern Texas. There was one of a murder in Midlothian, a 17-year-old named Richard Goglian Jr., I think is how it's pronounced, with two other teenagers, killed an undercover police officer by shooting him in the head. There were other murders with satanic undertones, according to the D article. One in a Dallas suburb where a teenage girl committed suicide in a cemetery near her home, leaving behind a diary in which she offered her life to the devil.
Oh my
and
God.
It said in this article that friends at her school said they understood that she was a part of a satanic group who had conducted a ritualistic death lottery in which the girl was chosen as the sacrifice.
What?
There was another case in a suburb of Greenville, again near Dallas, where a 16-year-old girl had been abducted out of a movie theater and was later found dead, buried in a shallow grave. And eventually there was the classic, well, in a bad way, the person who was charged and convicted of the crime, 666 tattooed on his forehead, had a bunch of satanic stuff in his bedroom.
So dumb.
Anton LaVey's satanic Bible.
Sure.
All the classic stuff. And so, also there is a black robe just like the one found in the home that had the mentally disabled people living there. And so people in Childress were passing this article around to each other like, oh my God, this is happening here. This is happening here. And so again, this hysteria based in something is growing and growing. And so it was pretty serious. And there was a store called Taylor's, which was the largest chain of bookstores in Dallas. And the buyer for Taylor's was quoted as saying the Satanic Bible had been a very good seller in recent years. And most of the buyers were teenagers.
Why are they selling that?
Mm.
Okay.
I don't know. And there is a police sergeant in a Dallas suburb that told the, again, I think this is still the D. So it told the magazine, the D, that he's sat in his office talking to a 12-year-old girl saying stories about drinking animal blood that she saw from an animal she saw get killed. Well, he has a daughter at home that's the same age playing with Barbie dolls.
What?
And he's just like, what is happening? And so readers of this article in Childress were looking at, you know, a list of warning signs that your teen may be involved in a satanic cult if X, Y, and Z. It had been apparently prepared by a professor of religious studies from the University of Denver and made with the assistance of the Cult Awareness Network.
I've heard of them, yeah.
Based in Chicago. Have you actually? Yeah. Oh.
I don't know if it's defunct or if it's still a thing, but no. Yeah.
So some of these warning signs involve like obsession with, you know, demonism, violent movies, books, videos, but also some of my favorite. It, and you'll see why. Interest in satanic symbols. Pentagrams, inverted crosses, which the three of us know the inverted cross is just St. Peter. Right, Frank?
Yes. Very dumb for Satanists to use. It is the cross of St. Peter.
Pentagrams, inverted crosses, demons, and werewolves. I don't know why, but that's satanic.
Can I quick add about the Cult Awareness Network? I know about them because they were active in 1978. That's when they started. They went after Scientology. Got them.
One.
During the bankruptcy of the organization, Scientology bought them created the new Cult Awareness Network. And it is now operated by the Church of Scientology.
Well, wait.
And I'm sure they investigate everyone except
them. In what year?
I think.
What year did that happen?
96.
Okay, so the Cult Awareness Network was still the normal Cult Awareness Network during this.
Correct, yeah.
Gotcha.
Yeah, it started in 78, so it was like 10 years into it.
There's one other, so I've hit you with a lot of different cases of these weird satanic killings that are going on. One last one was that a teenager from the town of Panhandle.
Really?
Who was reputed to be this, you know, ladies' man, like attractive young guy, murdered two people and attempted to murder a third shortly after he recorded a videotape. And he goes into this whole, like, psycho killer monologue recording himself. It feels kind of like found footagey. Where you just, I found this, and you just see this guy talking about what he's going to do.
Oh, my God.
And then he kills these people. Apparently, let me get you his name. Kenneth Glenn Milner. And so he was arrested after the killings. And I don't get this. Apparently when he was interviewed by a Texas Ranger, Milner said that all of this had begun, like all this satanic interest, when he was given a copy of the Necronomicon.
What?
That is a made up book.
Yeah, what?
From H.P. Lovecraft's mythos.
Or is it not made up?
I mean, the Necronomicon is from H.P. Lovecraft.
Yeah, because he read it. And just wrote about it.
Maybe. Listen to the latest MU episode, I see. But, yeah, so it was crazy. But he didn't say who gave him the book. So there's all this hysteria. There's all the rumors of people in town being involved, and then they all leave. There's other crazy crimes happening in other parts of Texas. And Deputy Bowen remember saying just people are scared because it's happening all over. Panhandle is nearby to Childress-ish. There were everything that happened in the Dallas suburbs. It's just people are really on edge, you know, all the looking for warning signs, all this stuff. But then Memorial Day, 1991. So we're jumping a couple years ahead. Tate Roland's sister Terry was found dead at the Wilkes house.
Oh.
And I think we'll end tonight with that as a part one. And we'll come back next Wednesday with a part two, going more into the rabbit hole now that Tate's sister also has been found dead a couple years later, almost 3 years later.
It's good to end on a happy note.
And it definitely gets crazy. We're sort of past the satanic part of this, in a sense. This, we're going to get into the, like, this is like the true crime. Like, what is going on? How conspiracies, all this stuff. So we'll end there for today, and we'll pick up on part two next Wednesday at 9 p.m. Do you guys have any final thoughts so far?
This is like a super minor thing, but who just gets a Necronomicon and then like reads it like cover to cover and was like, you know, they make some really solid points. Like,
I don't know.
That's a real mystery that I'm curious about.
Yeah, I mean, a lot of these, I didn't go into the details of those other killings, but they all have this satanic aspect to it, or someone dabbling in Satanism, or just there's iconography plastered everywhere.
Oh, man.
So.
What a cliffhanger.
Yeah, it is definitely odd for Terry now to show up dead about three years later.
Everything you've been saying, I keep going back and forth between like, oh, these are just crazy rumors that are just spreading like wildfire, and the parents are getting these pamphlets saying your kid might be in the satanic cult if they paint their nails black. But then it's like, but people are showing up dead.
Right. And still, you need to think about it. Chad's story still makes very little sense. And as Deputy Bowen put it, there were two rope marks on Tate's neck. And when someone hangs themselves, or they get hanged, I guess, in another way, it's one, not two.
And with the sister dead, it's starting to sound like that family is being targeted.
we'll definitely get into it. It goes much deeper.
I can't wait.
So, Aaron, any concluding thoughts?
This is a messed up episode, Nick.
I'm known for that, but now I'm not getting into really like the spooky stories. This is just like,
yeah,
this actually happened.
Another thing too, I guess I'd like to say is some of this stuff I've seen news articles recently of similar things, not like as widespread. Well, Mike, there was the one story with the guy that was like, oh yeah, I'm gonna kill my parents or whatever. There was someone in the news not too long ago that literally killed his parents because it was, you know, some whole like racial thing and all that. Yeah, it really? Crazy.
Oh.
So I hope it's not making a comeback is all I'm going to say.
Yeah, that would not be good.
Well, not if you're little blonde hair, blue eyed girls, I guess.
Yeah, and you know, that even adds more to it. He, you know, Tate said to Terry to, you know, keep her, your daughters like inside and safe. And the rumor that was spread was Tate was a part of it and he got killed because he didn't get the cult a blonde haired, blue eyed child.
Crazy.
So it's weird that like there are these little things where like it could all be hysteria, but then there are things that don't make sense. And then when we get into part two next time, it will really become clear that there is so much going on at this time in Childress, Texas. But with that, we'll end here for tonight. Follow us on wherever you get your podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Amazon, YouTube, Spotify. Check out soapbox.host. You can also listen on there. Email us your thoughts. Email us your concerns of cults near you.
Yes, we'll investigate. Or Aaron will. He's our boots on the ground guy.
Yeah. And tonight, maybe think about who your neighbors are.